Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. I am not a terrorist. I'm a sick mom. I need some help. This is what Carol Ann Gottbaum was screaming, apparently, at the Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport a couple days back, Monday. It was reported Monday. I believe this happened on Sunday. As she was, she got bounced off a flight. She showed up late for a flight and apparently went ballistic. Ended up in a jail cell and is now dead. Now, if this was the only story, if this were the only example of this, and this isn't to pick on the TSA, there's a larger issue here. It would perhaps be worthy of a comment, but not a commentary. But there's a larger issue, a much larger issue, and that is, has the rise of conservatives in general, the conservative worldview specifically, conservatives in media and politics over the past 26 years, led to the police statification of America? And was Carol Ann Gottbaum a victim of that? Of this 26-year rise in the police state here? Here's another example. This is one of the lead stories over at democraticunderground.com. And a shout-out to the great folks over there. It originates over at feministing.com. Teenage girl beaten, expelled, and arrested for dropping cake. This was reported in on a local TV station, Fox 11, that a young woman of color in L.A., in Los Angeles, and it'd be interesting to hear from some of our Los Angeles listeners about this, didn't pick up properly, apparently, a piece of birthday cake that she dropped on the floor to the satisfaction of the security guards, one of whom, and there's a photo of this, you can see it over at feministing.com or at democraticunderground.com, as he smashes her face down into a table and handcuffs her, breaking her wrist. The 16-year-old girl, African-American girl, says, "Hold still, nappy head." That's what he says to her during the attack. They've got the video of it. And then the note over at feministing.com says, "But it gets worse. When the girl's mother went to school to complain and rightfully demand that this guard be arrested, she was arrested and suspended from her job with the school district. So mom gets arrested and loses her job when she tries to show up to defend her daughter. One of the students who captured the assault on his cell phone was also beaten by the so-called security guards in this Los Angeles school." Carol Gottbaum in Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport. One of the workers in the airport told the New York Daily News, quote, "She looked really scared, really frightened. I think she was afraid to go to jail." The New York Daily News noting one of the officers, the Phoenix police spokesman, Sergeant Andy Hill, couldn't immediately explain why a distressed woman was left alone in handcuffs while seven police officers were in the security office. But they did leave her alone. Police officers, security officers, people working with people in distress, and I tell you this with some experience, from 1978 to 1983, I was the executive director of a residential treatment facility for emotionally disturbed and severely abused kids, and we had kids in there, including teenage boys who were bigger than me, who we had to learn how to restrain in a way that was not violent. to stop them from behaving in a violent, and we never had handcuffs, we never had pepper spray, we never had the instruments of torture and violence that are being used in police departments across the nation. How to talk a person down, how to hold a person and talk them down, how to restrain a person. This used to be just standard training. In Oak Park, I mean, this is how bizarre it gets. In Oak Park, a school has banned hugging. Now, this was a big deal for one of our kids. I'm not going to identify which one of our kids, but we used to live, for whatever reason, but in any case, we used to live in Newt Gingrich's district in Georgia. We lived in one of the northern suburbs of Atlanta in a very, you know, white bread, upper middle class neighborhood. And Newt was running for re-election as the education speaker of the House. And he had all these plans, and the general consensus was in the local schools was that because Newt was talking all about the schools, that any day now the TV cameras would show up, and they wanted to be sure that Newt looked good, so they wanted to be sure that they had all these, you know, well-dressed white kids, mostly, by and large, walking around, you know, very, oh boy, I'm in such a hurry to get from class to class. And so they banned conversation in the hall between classes for a couple of weeks. Well, the kids reacted to this in our child's middle school by hugging each other between classes as they went from class to class. Well, this totally flipped out the school because Newt was also anti-gay, and 12-year-olds typically are hugging people of the same sex as much or more often than they're hugging people of the opposite sex. You know, they're right at the edge of that stage where, you know, the opposite sex is still kind of creepy, or they're, you know, getting it. In any case, hugging people of the same gender, oh my God, he's also anti-gay, and they're hugging, and so they banned hugging. And so one of our three children led a sit-in at the school. So we get this call. Louise and I have to go down to the school, and the principal and the teachers, and they're, your kid is a troublemaker. Which led us to homeschool that child. But the point is, there's something just totally weird about being called in to a school and told that, you know, there's something terribly wrong here. Your child is hugging other children. And yet, in Los Angeles, there's no problem. In fact, if you're a parent and you go in and complain about your child having the stuffing beaten out of her because she didn't pick up a piece of cake properly from the floor, you get fired and you get arrested. Where are we going with this? You know, last year was the fourth year in a row that we arrested more people in this country for pot possession than for violent crimes. We have more people in prison in the United States than any other nation in the world, and there's some pretty damn repressive nations out there. We're looking at what's going on in Burma, where the monks are being slaughtered, apparently. And there's not a broad outcry in the United States. We're looking at the militarization. The Blackwater, Eric Prince is testifying before Congress today, the head of Blackwater. And we're looking not to say that this is exactly what I don't want to speak specifically of Blackwater, but broadly speaking, we're looking at the violence being wreaked on civilians in Iraq. Best estimates, at least 100,000, maybe as many as 1 million dead Iraqis as a direct consequence of our involvement in that country, and we shrug it off. In 1960, the year John Kennedy was arrested in the United States, we arrested 3.3 million people, and SWAT teams didn't exist. In 2004, that was up to 14 million people. We're busting people left and right, and we're doing it in incredibly violent ways. Paramilitary-style raids, SWAT team raids, have increased, and this is 40,000 a year by some estimates, have increased 1,300% since Ronald Reagan came into office. These 26 years of conservative rule are, in my opinion, what we are seeing is that they are turning America into a police state. And they're doing it because the conservative perspective is people are evil and you have to restrain them. Oh, 100 times a day, doors get kicked in the United States, and on average, one or two or three of them are the wrong doors. People get shot, people get killed, people are terrorized by SWAT teams that more often than not are simply serving warrants. The Cato Institute, the Libertarian Cato Institute, put together a whole policy paper on this thing. They said these raids, 40,000 a year by one estimate, are needlessly subjecting nonviolent offenders, bystanders, and wrongly targeted civilians to the terror of having their homes invaded while they're sleeping, usually by teams of heavily armed paramilitary units dressed not as peace officers, but as soldiers. Has the rise of conservatism in American media and politics led to a police state? 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Paul Craig Roberts, the former Undersecretary of the Treasury of the Reagan administration, relatively frequent guest on this program, blogging over at lewrockwell.com or writing. He says, last week we had the case of the University of Florida student who was repeatedly tasered without cause for asking Senator Kerry some good questions. UCLA student was tasered by police without call for studying in the university library without having a student ID on him. Remember when that happened? Here's the question. Has the rise of conservatives in media and politics over the past 26 years led to a police state in America? And was Carol Ann Gottbaum a victim of that? I submit the answer is yes. And the reason why is because the fundamental conservative perspective on humanity is that people are fundamentally and essentially flawed and evil, that we are all the victims of Eve having talked Adam into eating that apple, that unlike every other part of nature, we are totally unique and completely evil. Not completely. It's our first instinct. For all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, writ large. And therefore, the institutions of government, the purpose of government is to restrain people because they are fundamentally evil. So we need heavy and strong police and a little brutality once in a while, it'll slap some sense into them. Whereas the ideal upon which this country was founded came out of the writing of folks like from the Enlightenment, like Jean-Jacques Rousseau from France, or John Locke from the United Kingdom, writing in the 1600s, suggesting that unlike Thomas Hobbes's view of the human race, that in his natural state, man is without arts, without letters, without civilization, would be reduced to a nasty, short, and brutish life, to badly paraphrase Thomas Hobbes from Leviathan. Unlike Hobbes's point of view, Locke and Rousseau and the Enlightenment thinkers who followed them, Jefferson, Madison, Mason, that they concluded that humanity is essentially decent, that we are pretty much just like everything else in nature, that we're a part of it all, that it's all part of us, we're interpenetrated by nature, here we are. And that the purpose of society, the reason why governments are instituted among men, to quote the Constitution, or to quote the Declaration of Independence, is to facilitate not the violent repression of evil in people, but rather to allow the very best in people to come out, to provide the greatest opportunity for people, to provide people with an opportunity to achieve. We, the people, of the United States, opens the Constitution of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. It doesn't say in order to form a police, a more perfect union, establish justice, not violence, not clamp down, justice. Ensure domestic tranquility. Not, as John Kennedy said in June 10th, 1963 at Michigan State University, he said, "We don't seek the peace of the grave. Provide for the common defense." That's the one place in the preamble of the Constitution where it talks about the military or police. Provide. And it's also the only one of these items which is not capitalized. The word defense is not capitalized, whereas the word union is capitalized, the word tranquility is capitalized, the word welfare is capitalized, the words blessings and liberty are capitalized, and the word posterity is capitalized. Provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, capital W, and secure the blessings of liberty, capital B, capital L, to ourselves and our, capital P, posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States. The liberal founders of this country saw democracy, small d democracy, as something that would help us all rise up, to lift up, to achieve our greatest potential. And the conservative worldview, the conservative perspective on this, has been from the get-go twofold. Number one, that the only purpose of government should be to provide essentially repression. And number two, that the purpose of the free market should be to provide for all other social ills, to take care of every other problem. Richard Nixon, for example, in the debate between Nixon and Kennedy in 1960, the Kennedy-Nixon debates, I'll share a clip of this with you right after the break. It's fascinating. Richard Nixon and John Kennedy were asked the question, what are we going to do about the fact that segregation is widespread in the United States, that, you know, even though slavery has been outlawed, that there is not just a lack of opportunity for African Americans, there's violence against them. That they're not allowed to go to whites-only schools, that there are places in America where that are whites-only. And Nixon gave the classic conservative answer, and Kennedy the classic liberal. This has to do with worldviews, fundamental worldviews. I'll share that with you right after the break, and then we'll take your calls on this issue. Has the rise in conservatism in media and politics over the past 26 years in America led to a police state, and was Carol Ann Gottbaum a victim of it? 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
That's not the world I live in. This is not the life for me. Cause my world's bigger than your problems, and it's bigger than me. That's not the world I live in. This is not the life for me. Cause my world's bigger than your problems, and it's bigger than me.
So are the conservatives bringing us a police state, or is this just the way it should be? Is it just that there's too many people, and we need to restrain them? Fundamentally, in my mind, this has to do with the worldview. And in just a moment, we're taking your calls and thoughts on this. I promised you just a clip of here Nixon and Kennedy talking about this and reflecting, again, as I said, this fundamental schism in worldview. Presented with the question, what should be done about Brown versus Board of Education, which in some ways brings us back to the story that we started here of this young woman of color in Los Angeles who had her wrist broken by a school officer as he was taking her down for not appropriately, in his mind, cleaning up a piece of cake. And yes, I'm sure there's more to the story, but that's on its face. That's the story that we have. So Nixon was asked, you know, what should government do? What is what this gets right down to is, what is the role of government? And Nixon saw the role of government as being one that was essentially punitive. And when it came to helping people, you should just leave it to the corporations. Here's his answer.
I have talked to Negro mothers. I've heard them try to explain how they tell their children how they can go into a store and buy a loaf of bread, but then can't go into that store and sit at the counter and get a Coca-Cola. This is wrong, and we have to do something about it. So under the circumstances, what do we do? Well, what we do is what the Attorney General of the United States did under the direction of the President. Call in the owners of chain stores and get them to take action.
Yes. So Nixon says the solution to segregated lunch counters in the United States is to call in the chain store owners and ask them to please do something. Kennedy says, no, we use the force of government. I realize I'm using the word force here. But we use the force of government to change our public institutions in ways that are essentially more humane. Jack Kennedy.
Senator Kennedy.
Well, Mr. Nixon hasn't discussed the two basic questions. What is going to be done and what will be his policy on implementing the Supreme Court decision of 1954? Giving aid to schools technically that are trying to carry out the decision is not the great question. Secondly, what's he going to do to provide fair employment? He's been the head of the Committee on Government Contracts. He's carried out two cases, both in the District of Columbia. He has not indicated his support of an attempt to provide fair employment practices around the country.
See, this is the point. Kennedy is saying, you know, Nixon is just, he doesn't believe in using government for social engineering to provide for a better world, as is outlined in the Constitution, the preamble of the Constitution of the United States. And so it just, you know, it just puts it in fairly stark relief, I think. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jane in Seattle. Hey, Jane, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Is it okay if I briefly change my comments based on what I told the screener?
Sure.
Yes. I am a licensed security officer in the state of Washington for 6 years. I have talked to you before. I'm a progressive, and I think two things, or maybe more, but at this point, just two to allow other people to speak. I think that the philosophy is wrong by our country at the present time and for many years in the past to try to maintain and control citizenry like that in a negative way. I think it's based in fear, and I think the fear has been created by these powers that have influenced our country and the approach, like, you know, tasering people and hurting citizens.
Yeah.
Yesterday, my grandson was influenced by the principal and pulled out of his school to talk to the security officer. And I'm like, what is going on? Now, maybe he wanted to use the security officer as a role model for my little grandson, who was only 5 years old.
Yeah, that's, again, it gets back to this thing of, you know, our new authority figures are cops, basically, and our role model. Good point, Carol. Thank you. Vic in Cedar Creek, Texas. Hey, Vic.
Hello, Tom.
Hey.
Well, you know, people just fail to learn from history in all of this. And this police state, you know, which I happen to agree with you, you know, everything you said about it today, it has been predicted in history. You know, since there's nobody to police the United States, according to Abraham Lincoln, will never be destroyed from outside. He said, if we falter and lose our freedoms, it is because we destroyed ourselves. And what I also, I'm sure you're a student of Alexis de Tocqueville.
Yeah, I've read Democracy in America, published in 1836. Yeah.
And in addition to reading your books, people should go to that on the internet and see what the warnings of this fellow was.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I in my book, Unequal Protection, one of the last chapters of that book, I quoted extensively from one of the last chapters of de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. De Tocqueville was a British aristocrat, a young man who came over to the United States, spent 6 months traveling around, in 1836. Democracy in America was written that year, and it was published in 1838, and it was the bestseller in the world for about a decade. And he was very skeptical of the American experiment. And toward the end of the book, he has a chapter called What America or What Democracies Should Be Afraid Of, or words to that effect. It's actually a longer title. And he talks about the power, this vast tutelary power. And I think, frankly, it spooked me. It was almost like he was talking about the television nation.
Hey, Tom.
Yeah.
He said, if the free institutions of America are destroyed, well, we could underscore the destroyed and make that into a verb. And then it gets a little flowery. Then he says anarchy will result, but it will have been brought about by despotism. Well, how, you know, we are in the land of despotism, but I don't see, you know, the the local news and everybody talks about the people are fed up with this, but everybody's going along with their daily lives. I guess until they can't watch football and buy a six-pack of beer and turn on lights, then everything's fine, you know.
Yeah, which brings us the question, is it going to, like it did in 1929 through 1932, is it going to take another Great Depression, another Republican Great Depression, to bring about the social change? Because that was when we flipped from conservative economic and governing philosophies from 1918 until 1929 or 1932, from that period into Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. Good point, Vic. Thank you very much. John in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Tom, good morning. I've got a little problem with the way that you distort facts to come up with a premise. Let me give you an example. This fellow down in Florida, this kid, was not tasered because he asked questions. And that's what the left, that's their
life. Oh, you're talking about in John Kerry, in the case of John Kerry?
Yes.
Yeah, that wasn't my principal example. It appears that increasingly that he was essentially trying to do theater. But the larger question is, should a taser be our response to something like that? I mean, why not just walk him out of the building?
Well, did you see him? He was about 6'3". There were two of the officers were women. He was running around displaying. I mean, the guy looked like he was on ecstasy. I would have tasered him 10 minutes earlier. The problem is that what you do is you have to demonize something and create some sort of boogeyman conservative. Do you think what, before Reagan was president in the 60s, was police brutality worse then or is it worse now?
Well, it depends. I would say that broadly speaking, against people of color, probably before Reagan it was worse than it is now. Not because of anything Reagan did, but just because America has become more tolerant in many ways. But I would also say that over the last 15 years or so, we've been backsliding pretty aggressively, particularly in the South. And
oh,
I say that
God.
As somebody who lived in the South for 14 years.
Oh, my gosh. It's the civil rights and the amount of lawyers that are ready to take the cases. It's so much better than it ever was in this country. But what you have to do now on the left is you create this myth. It's like, and you'll.
So you really think, John, that 100 SWAT teams kicking in doors across America a day is a fine thing? You think it's fine that police departments are being offered tanks and military equipment? The militarization of the police departments all across the United States, something we've never seen before in this country, is just a fine thing.
Well, when you've got people with machine guns and meth labs destroying the children of this country and cities demanding. Stuff like that. I mean,
we're talking about 17,000 local police forces are now equipped with military equipment, which includes things like Black Hawk helicopters, machine guns, grenade launchers, battering rams, explosives, chemical sprays, body armor, night vision, repelling gear, armored vehicles.
Well, okay, why shouldn't cops at night have the same tools that the Army does? I mean, if you live in a city like Philadelphia or Oakland, are you telling me that the people in those cities don't deserve the best technology so that their kids can walk to school?
What I'm telling you is that our society is becoming more coarse and more violent, and we're becoming more accepting of it. And in my opinion, there are two core keys to this. One is the ongoing gradual destruction of the middle class, which drives crime up, and we know that. And the other is the militarization, the hyper-militarization, and the celebration of the militarization of police departments in the United States.
Yeah, well, you have to say that there's so many myths that you guys have on the left. Like, I mean, and you'll go to any extreme. If you're worried about crime, why do you have Scott Ritter on your program?
I would submit to you, John, that if we were to take care of the people of the United States, if people's basic needs were met, if you could get a good job without panicking, we wouldn't have half the crime problem that we have right now. I mean, when your Scott Ritter comment was, that's it. When the Irish came over, they were, it's the Irish criminals, right? I mean, there's got to be something genetically wrong with them. The first wave of Irish immigrants in the 1840s after the potato famine. When the first big wave of Italian immigrants in the 1870s, the Italians, they're terrible people. Let's ghettoize. And within a generation, they were like, they're just like the rest of us. They're part of America now. I mean, it's time for us to reach out and say, we're all part of America. We're going to take this country back. 45 minutes.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, this weekend, Saturday, I'll be at the Green Festival in Washington, D.C., speaking on the main stage at 6 p.m. It's the Washington, D.C. Green Festival. You can easily Google the thing. There's a link to it from our website as well. On the 26th, I'll be in Seattle at the L.A. Bay Bookstore. And on the 27th of October at Sonoma State University, receiving a Project Censored Award. First place this year. It's the fourth time I've won a Project Censored Award in the last 6 years. It's quite an honor. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Tim in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Great. What's up?
Yeah, before I get to my comment and question, the thing that happened in L.A. was not in L.A. Unified School District, but it was in Palmdale/Lancaster area. So it's okay. Not L.A. Unified School District. But yes, I agree with you that there is a pattern of abuse. For example, like in Florida, where that man was arrested, for DUI. He was strapped down, shocked, because he refused to give a urine sample. So the sheriff deputy shocked him, and he was forced to give a urine sample.
Yeah, it's like there's this coarsening of our culture. I mean, Blackwater patrolling the streets of New Orleans. And it's the media just gets hysterical and feeds into it. They were reporting on CNN that people were shooting at helicopters that were coming to help. Turns out those reports were totally phony. Not that CNN had phonied them, but the reports that they were reporting on were phony. Nobody was shooting at any helicopters. And yet, right. To this day, you have conservatives repeating that myth to justify the hypermilitarization of New Orleans.
I got a question. Do you think that because of the blogs that are coming out, that these stories are popping up more and more because there's more exposures from, the progressives are exposing the truth as opposed to, say, like you said, 26 years ago, this form of abuse has been going on, but we never really heard about it.
Yeah, it was more underground then, certainly, absolutely. Tim, thanks for the call. Andre in Columbia, South Carolina, listening to WOIC. Hey, Andre.
Hey, Tom. Love your show. I'm a black man in the South, deep South, South Carolina. I'm married to a white lady, and, we kind of see both sides, and I agree with that it seems that we've regressed a bit. But, however, I do think that there is some sensationalism going on. When you look always for one individual who has been wronged, you'll find one in every
sure.
community. And by setting up these, I call straw man arguments that, American system is absolutely, totally unfair to Afro-Americans, you divide us. We need to.
Yeah, well, I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting almost has nothing to do, or very little to do, with race. Although I would say that people who are on the short end of the stick with regard to economy, which although there's more whites in poverty in the United States than there are African Americans, there's more whites in general than there are African Americans. But this ultimately is an economic issue, and it ultimately is an issue that has to do with how people are perceived. And what we're seeing is this coarsening of the perception of people in the United States, an increased tolerance for violence.
I agree with you, and I'm not saying that you're trying to divide us on the basis of race.
No, and I think it's happening in culture as well, in movies and music, right across the board. I think that we're seeing an increased tolerance for violence and a decrease we used to view violence with horror.
Absolutely, absolutely. The young man who was tasered at the convention for, I think it was Kerry. You didn't see a lot of civil rights people coming out to support him. And that's wrong.
Well, until we know, exactly what his motives are. But yeah, your point is well made, Andre. And thank you very much. Carol in Phoenix, Arizona. Carol, what's on your mind?
Hi, how are you?
Good. But I'll get better. What's up?
I was going to ask you if you're going to get better.
I am.
I have a feeling that the biggest problem that we have is the leadership in the country, because I think the leadership, George Bush, has given us permission to lose that veneer of civility that kept people in line.
I would agree with that. And I think that they're, probably one of the lowest crime places in the world in the 20th century was any major city in Germany in 1940. you know, or 1938 or 9. I mean, if you want no crime and you want very, you know, everybody as they walk by, the Grüße Gott, the Guten Tag, everybody's very, you know, you have a police state. You know, Franco's Italy, Franco's Spain, Mussolini's Italy, Hitler's Germany. There was very, very little crime. Is that the way you want to do away with crime? I would say no. I would point out that there's also very little crime in Sweden and Norway, you know, back before they were invaded by the Nazis and now, and it's because broad, widespread economic opportunity and because there's a culture that celebrates life and humanity rather than you know, death and violence. Carol, thank you very much. Ed in Mission Viejo, California. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Tom. Mine Fuhrer George W. has done a good job.
Tragically.
Yesterday, for the first time in almost 28 years, I was stopped by the police. And I really wanted to be arrested just because I was just walking. And they started asking me questions, what I'm doing in the area when I live here.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was interesting that there was just no other reason than I wear blue jeans, a T-shirt, and I have a beard.
Yeah.
And
yeah. How dare you be in this community?
Dare I be in this rich neighborhood? Because
Look like a rich guy.
No, I don't.
You weren't wearing a suit and you weren't clean shaven. Oh man, it is the police statification of America. Ed, thanks for your story. Where are we going with this? I mean, you know, how much longer? How much longer? Should we change our constitution, maybe? Larry Sabato thinks so. We'll be talking with him next. I frankly disagree. It's going to be an interesting conversation. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back. So how do we put our country back together again? To paraphrase the old nursery rhyme, Thomas Jefferson suggested that every generation should reinvent the Constitution. And he defined a generation as every 19 years. Larry Sabato is of a similar mind. His new book, A More Perfect Constitution, 23 Proposals to Revitalize Our Constitution and Make America a Fairer Country. The website, amoreperfectconstitution.com. Larry Sabato, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Tom, and thanks for giving some attention to the book on its launch date.
You're welcome. I can't say I've read every word in the book, but I've read a good chunk of it, in particular your specific proposals and your last chapter where you take on the arguments that I will make, which is that we don't want to open up the process of tinkering with our Constitution at a time when only by a very, very tiny thread do we have a majority of people in the House and Senate, and frankly in the 35 or 37 states that would be required for ratification, who are of a... frankly, of the mind of the liberal founders of this country.
I'm concerned that
this could open the Constitution up to being hijacked by the Jerry Falwells of the world.
All right,
although
now,
he's not with
us. Let me point out a critical factor. We're talking about a constitutional convention that's a generation away. I mean, I'm with you in the sense that this is not something that should be undertaken now. It should not be undertaken without the most careful study, debate, discussion. And it's going to take a generation just to get people to think about some of the key issues like war powers, trying to reclaim for the legislative branch some of the war powers that they've lost to the presidency over decades.
But that's not a consequence of the Constitution. I mean, the fact of the matter is the Constitution is quite explicit that, you know, only Congress has the power to make war, period. And in fact, it even says that the military has to be refunded every 2 years. In other words, they force Congress to revisit every 2 years by constitutional order whether or not a war shall continue, whether or not the military shall, for that matter, even continue to exist. I mean, you'll recall there was a debate in the founding of this country about the first 20, 30 years of this country, in fact, about whether or not we should even have a standing army during time of peace.
Right. Yes.
So it's not, the problem is not the Constitution, in my opinion. It's the people who have corrupted it.
Well, I would argue that it's essential to have a constitutional amendment that reclaims for Congress its role in war making. And as you know, my proposal is that every 6 months, Congress must, without extended debate, vote to either extend a foreign involvement or to order that all combat troops be withdrawn within a year. And if even one House, either the House or the Senate, chooses not to extend the foreign involvement, it's over. Now, why is that needed? Because it changes the whole fulcrum of the war debate. Right now, you have to get a two-thirds majority to override a presidential veto to end the war. That's really what
you
have to do.
No, you don't. All you have to do is have 40. In the Senate, you only need 40 votes. To end a war, to simply say, no, we're not going to send you the money. Because Congress has the sole power that you're using the innocent bystander argument, to quote David Sirota, and it's wrong. Congress, because Bush cannot have a war if he doesn't have the money for the war. And Congress can simply say, sorry, we're not going to give you the money. Now, they haven't had the intestinal fortitude to do so far, but that's a very easy way to stop a war, and that's why it was built into the Constitution that every 2 years, any funding of the Department of Defense had to be revisited and reauthorized by Congress.
Yeah, but Tom, the Democrats don't have enough votes to do that. The Republicans have 49. No, they got 49 senators.
It only takes 40 votes to stop legislation.
No. Look, here's the key. With my proposal, one House, 51 votes in the Senate, assume you got all 100 voting, just a simple majority, 218 in the House, would end an unpopular foreign war. I think
that majority can end it right now by simply saying, no, we're not going to vote yes on money for a war.
And, Tom, your way's not working, and I think mine would. I mean, it's that simple.
So why would Congress, if they're not willing to say, no, George, we won't give you the money, why would they be willing to say, yes, George, we won't give you the money?
Because I think right now there's already a majority in the Senate that is 51 votes that would vote to withdraw within a year. The House is more problematic because of the blue dogs, the more conservative.
Well, but the filibuster is not in the Constitution. It's in the Senate rules.
Sorry?
I mean, the filibuster is not, you know, the 60 votes to cut off debate. The filibuster, that's not in the Constitution. That's a Senate rule. And as we learned, you know, a couple of years ago when the Republicans were threatening to pull the nuclear option and do away with that rule, it's a rule that the Senate, by a majority, by the way, by a 51-vote majority, can do away with. They can change their own rules.
Sure. No, I understand that. But remember, there are a certain number of Democrats who want to preserve the filibuster rule for their own purposes. It may have nothing to do with the war. And I'm not really arguing with you about your point, because your point is valid. But what I'm suggesting is this procedure, this automatic procedure every 6 months, would not only give Congress the opportunity, it would make Congress face up to the vote about whether or not to extend foreign involvement in an unpopular war. They would have to do it.
Right. We're talking with Larry Sabato, his new book, A More Perfect Constitution, 23 Proposals to Revitalize Our Constitution and Make America a Fairer Country. Larry, in the two or three minutes that we have left, there's no way we can go through all 23. What are the highlights? What are the most important, in your mind, proposals to change the Constitution?
Well, you know, I've ranged pretty widely, as you've seen. I've restructured the presidency. I go to a confirmation vote at the end of 5 years as to whether a president gets an additional 2 years or not, rather than having another partisan election in the middle, which I believe encourages, for example, has encouraged George Bush over his first term to stay in touch and make most of his decisions based on what the right wing of the Republican Party wants, rather than what a majority of the American people would want. They're much more centrist. They're not necessarily liberal, but they're more centrist. I'd like to see a confirmation election. In Congress, I changed the length of the terms and actually kind of convert to a semi-parliamentary system by having the House and the Senate elected at the same time as the President every time the President's on the ballot. So there can be variable terms for the House and the Senate. And, you know, the Supreme Court and all court jurisdictions, I have 15-year maximum terms, lifetime terms. You can't serve more than 15 years as a district judge, no more than 15 years as an appellate judge, no more than 15 years as a Supreme Court justice.
Why?
There are 23 of them. Well, because I think the longer you're on the court, whether you're conservative or liberal, the arrogance factor grows, the Mount Olympian factor grows, you become more distant from new generations. It's important to have turnover.
But on the other hand, if you know that you're going to be out of it, if you're going to be kicked out on your butt within the next 2 years, you're going to start making decisions and sucking up to the economic interests that might hire you when you get out.
Well, look, a lot of them already complained about the salary, Tom, and they're leaving anyway because they say that the salary is not sufficient.
A small number, but most of them are, you know, get it that they've got enough that they're in the upper middle class and they've got a good pension.
Yeah, for the most part, that's absolutely the case. But, you know, this is strongly supported by law faculties across America. They've all come to the term limits solution on courts. I favor term limits for legislators. You know, if presidents have term limits, I want legislators to have generous.
Well, we have term limits in the United States. They're called elections.
Well, yeah, they don't work very well, do they? That's why we get some people serving 40 or 50 years.
Yeah, I would submit to you that one of the reasons that they don't work is because of redistricting and gerrymandering, and because the two parties have become so ossified, so calcified, and the one way to break that up is with instant runoff voting.
Is that one of your proposals? That's one of my proposals, is to have nonpartisan redistricting for the House of Representatives and all 50 state legislatures through a panel. You can either have a panel of judges, you can have a nonpartisan commission, you can do it the way Iowa does it, which I think is a superb way, using nonpartisan experts. And
this is clearly what was envisioned by the founders in the very beginning. What about instant runoff voting?
I like the idea of instant runoff voting. I didn't.
We don't need to change the Constitution to do it.
I didn't put it in the Constitution, but you mentioned my website, amoreperfectconstitution.com. I'm encouraging people to go there and list a 24th idea. I'm just trying to start a debate and a discussion about what ought to be changed after 220 years, because one thing's for sure, large parts of the Constitution are archaic. Not the Bill of Rights, not separation of powers, but there are pieces that are archaic. It's time for change. It's overdue.
Perhaps the Third Amendment. I don't think anybody has used the Third Amendment about quartering soldiers in a long time.
Yeah, well, you're right.
There's a lot of it that it would be nice if we just used it.
Yeah, no, well, there you go.
Okay, Larry Sabato, his new book, A More Perfect Constitution, 23 Proposals to Revitalize Our Constitution and Make America a Fairer Country. Thought-provoking reading. Larry, thanks a lot for coming on with us.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Good talking with you. AmorePerfectConstitution.com is website as well. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
So speaking of how to stop funding unpopular wars in faraway places, Larry Sabato suggested we need to write it into the Constitution that instead of every 2 years Congress having to revisit the entire military budget, that they should do it every 6 months. It's an interesting idea. I mean, you know, Larry has some very interesting ideas there. But what we're seeing right now is that as this war is increasingly unpopular, now David Obey, the Democrat from Wisconsin and chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, the committee that has to come up with the money for George to have his little war, says he's not going to give him the money. He's not going to report a bill out of committee, this war supplemental spending bill, unless the White House does three fundamental changes in their Iraq strategy. I mean, this is absolutely great. Obi says, number one, the White House has to ensure a specific goal to end U.S. involvement in Iraq. Number two, we have to ensure that our troops receive adequate downtime between deployments. This is the essentially the bill that got shot down in the Senate last week. And number three, begin a broad-scale diplomatic offensive involving other countries in the region. A diplomatic offensive. Obi says he's soon going to unveil a surtax designed to raise $140 to $150 billion. He said, we need to stop pretending that this war doesn't cost anything. So essentially what he is saying to George W. Bush, to the White House, is, okay, you guys want to have a war? We have not just a right, but an obligation to make sure that if we're handing you the money, that we also have some say in how this war is fought or this occupation is conducted. And we want to make sure that our troops are taken care of. We want to make sure that other countries in the region are being brought in a diplomatic way. And by the way, you don't just get to borrow this money from our children and our grandchildren like you have the half a trillion dollars so far. No more borrowing. No more of these special appropriations that are not part of the pay-as-you-go program. You're going to have to figure out a way to pay for this thing. Now, let's see. What should we surtax in order to come up with $150 billion for war? How about a tax on the profits of companies that make things for war? That's an interesting one. Of course, in this, you know, hyper everything goes economy kind of time, that may just cause all the military machine companies and weapons of death companies. We are, by the way, now the largest exporter in the world of weapons of death, of military products. Might cause them all to do what Halliburton is doing, move to the United Arab Emirates, move to Dubai, and reincorporate there, where you only have to keep records for 1 year, and then you can destroy them, and you're relatively immune from prosecution under U.S. laws. Which goes back to why we need to change our trade laws. And we need to go back to domestic content laws, and let's bring some of our jobs home. Should be a fine idea. I want to get into that in some more detail in our third hour, actually. How do we revive the American dream? But right now, what changes do you think that we should be making in our Constitution, if any? I can see the Third Amendment, which says you can't quarter soldiers in your home. You know, Although, now the Posse Comitatus has gone away, I mean, we may have a renewed need for the Third Amendment. Now that the Republicans have destroyed Posse Comitatus, the law that was passed in the 1870s after the Civil War that said that the government shall never again turn its guns on its own people. That it is illegal, or it was illegal, for 75 years in the United States. Or no, it's for 125 years in the United States. It was illegal for the federal government to use the federal military against citizens of the United States on U.S. property, within the United States. That's the job of police. If people are disorderly, it's the job of police. Never again, they said in the 1870s when they passed the Posse Comitatus Act, never again will we have a government turning its guns on its own people. That's gone now. Which means that we may have private forces. They may outsource this stuff to Blackwater like they did it down in New Orleans and other companies like them. Or we may have the actual federal forces, and the advantage from the point of view of a Reich is that if you have people from, say, New York or New Jersey or New Hampshire or Vermont serving in, say, Texas or Arizona, they're far more likely to shoot at people and to mistreat people and to crack down on people the way that you're seeing in Burma right now than if they are from the state that they are operating in. Local folks are much less likely to shoot it at their neighbors, is the bottom line. So it may be that we need to bring back, that we need to keep the Third Amendment that says you can't quarter soldiers, because now we have the potential for domestic soldiers. Are we going down the road to fascism at home as well? 27 minutes past the hour.
is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
666-3023-2070. Indeed. And not just those rascals, there's another rascal as well.
Condescending crimes, making money, selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts.
It's our Rush Alert.
I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud, can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic cuss.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi.
That's right. Yes, our Rush Alert for the day. And actually, in the last trends ratings, our program beat Limbaugh right here in Portland, Oregon. Anyway, here's the deal. Harry Reid, on the floor of the Senate, is saying freedom of speech is one of our country's most cherished values. This is his anti-Rush speech. He says nothing sets us further apart than the countries and regimes we oppose than our belief that everyone's opinion matters and everyone has a right to express it. That's why when we hear things on the radio that are offensive, by and large, we tolerate them. But last week, Rush Limbaugh went way over the line. And while we respect his right to say anything he likes, his unpatriotic comments cannot be ignored. As Jane Hampshire so articulately blogs over at firedoglake.com and was reposted on Huffington Post, Harry, Limbaugh didn't go over the line. And it's not the business of Congress to decide what a talk show host should say or not say. He didn't go over a line that the Senate should deal with. He did, however, go over a line that Armed Forces Radio should deal with. This is a guy whose show is broadcast every single day to nearly a million troops in 177 countries. An armed force, our military, that according to a poll from earlier this year, only 35% of which supports Bush's handling of the war. 42% disapprove. A full 37% say we never should have even started it. This is their network, too, as Jane Hampshire notes. So Harry Reid and members of the House and Senate, instead of just complaining about Limbaugh, or instead of just trying to censure him or trying to, we're going to see your MoveOn.org ad and raise you a Limbaugh, just say to Armed Forces Radio, either Limbaugh goes off the air on Armed Forces Radio, or this program or some other program goes on for an equal amount of time to balance his programming, because our soldiers all around the world are hearing only his side of the story. And it's a very decided, distorted side it is. So, our Limbaugh alert for the day.
In closing, let me say that each and every day, I'm an evil, rotten, egotistical snob. I'm the capo, the cop, the Joe McCarthy-like Gestapo, the right-wing, foam-of-the-mouth, jack-booted slob, the democratic trasher, years of liberal bashing with the equivalent compassion of a grommet. With the IQ of a pig, I'm a fat, obnoxious pig. And the truth of the matter is, I'm vomit. Because I'm not.
It's 37 minutes past the hour. It's 866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com. Our blog is over at airamerica.com. Tomas in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, Tomas, what's up?
How you doing, sir? You were asking about what different changes we can make in our government, and I think that the Senate needs just to be deleted. You know, I think we should have a unicameral government. Because, tell me if I'm wrong, you're a historian, but the Senate was just a result of the Great Compromise, correct? when it
the Senate, yeah, there was, well, in part. I mean, there was two things. Number one, the framers of the Constitution wanted there to be two bodies, two deliberative bodies, two separate deliberative bodies that had somewhat different powers so that they could serve as a check against each other, number one. And number two, the Senate was, each state had two senators so that even the small states, I mean, you had small states like Delaware and Rhode Island that were saying, hey, you know, if we have to have a number of members of the House of Representatives based on our population, we'll never have any say in anything, and therefore we're not going to play in this game. And so they said, okay, you can have two senators. Every state has two senators regardless of its size. And yeah, you're right. That was part of the compromise. But, you know, I think it's that first, the first reason of having a balance between the House and the Senate, I think that's a very good and important one.
I don't. I mean, we have, you know, Alaska, which has less people in it, I think, than Washington, D.C., and they have two senators, you know.
But that doesn't mean that they shouldn't have them. What that means is that Washington, D.C. should have representation.
No, but it's unequal representation. How can you have, you know, 300,000 people with the same representative power as, you know, 30 million people? I mean,
yeah, in California, for example.
No matter what happens in the House, Tom, it has to go through the Senate.
Yeah, no, your point is well taken, Tomas, that in California, for example, Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer are representing, you know, each one represents, I don't know how many people, but versus Joe Biden in Delaware representing a much smaller number of people, so that arguably the people in Delaware have much more representation, disproportionately, massively disproportionately larger representation in the Senate. But that's the way it is. I mean, we have these individuals. I think what you could draw out of that is probably a good case for splitting California in half and making two states out of it.
Well, I mean, look at some of the states. The states have Senates and Houses, except for Nebraska, but usually in the states, the Senate is elected at large, or they have each senator has the same more or less same amount of people that they represent, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that it should be the same on a national level. It's
but see, the states don't need to keep the counties together. I mean, I get your point, Tomas. I absolutely get your point, but I don't think it's going to happen. It's going to require a massive change in the Constitution. And B, I really like the idea, frankly, that a small state can have a...
When you become president, I want you to think about that, okay?
Okay, Tomas, thanks a lot for the call. I really like the idea that a small state, an underrepresented perhaps state, can have a really feisty senator and you know, get out there and say things that need to be said. I think it's a fine thing. Dan in San Diego. Hey, Dan.
Jumping quickly on what that caller just said, yeah, I think it's okay to have two senators, and it's a compromise, but it's also one reason why we shouldn't have the electoral college, because people get two senators no matter what, so they do have representation regardless of population size.
Now, here's why we should keep the electoral college. The electoral college, the number of electors each state has, is the sum, the combined total, of the number of members of the House of Representatives, which broadly represents their population, plus their two senators. So a tiny state like Vermont or Rhode Island has three electors, and a larger state like California has however many you have. I don't remember how many members of the House you have, but, you know, 30-some-odd or 40, whatever it is.
Yeah,
and pardon?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and if we were to do away with the Electoral College and simply say that elections are held at large, or if you were to eliminate senators from the Electoral College mix numerically so that states actually, you know, population-wise were represented, then it would be possible in the United States to run for president in only about 13 or 14 states. You could just pick the most populous states and say, that's it, I'm only going to run in these states, I'm going to completely ignore the rest of America, and frankly, the concerns of the rest of America. You could run an election campaign and win it based entirely on regional issues and interests. And right now with the Electoral College, that's not possible. And therefore, I think it's a good thing.
I didn't look at it that way, so that's a good point. Anyway, that was way off what I was calling about. I wanted to talk about the culture of brutality and that one previous caller. But I think the culture of brutality, part of it is desensitization to violence. And, you know, there's just an inordinate amount of it, you know, violence and dysfunctionalism in the media. You know, little focus on consequences and so on and so forth. And the caller who talked about the myths on the left, he's, you know, essentially portrayed the concerns that we on the left has. He portrayed it, I guess, sort of as a phony victimization, and he ignored, you know, that the cons, they're victims of excessive force as well. And, you know, he also mentioned the cops need more firepower, otherwise they would be outgunned, and that, I guess that's what he said in a way. And
and in a way that was the argument that was made during Prohibition. You know, you've got notorious criminals out there. You got Al Capone with his machine gun, his Tommy gun, and so the cops need Tommy guns. Well, when they did away with Prohibition, suddenly Al Capone was out of business. Right. I mean, you know, the ending of Prohibition put a lot of these organized criminals out of business, and they had to move into other things that were prohibited, like prostitution, loan sharking, things like that. And you know, as a consequence, and drugs. And that's why I think that, you know, the decriminalization of most drugs would break the back of organized crime and would probably dramatically reduce the need for the weaponry that is alleged to be needed. Dan, thanks for your call. Good point, and interesting one. Tom in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Tom, got to take a break in about a minute. What's up?
Hey, real quick about Tom Ostrom from Grand Rapids. The Senate was never intended to represent the people. They represent the state. The Congress is represents the people, but that's not what I call it.
Good point. Excellent point. Thank you.
Well, I'm calling about a lot of what we had to do yesterday about what we might be invading Iran and the reasoning that the White House is giving. I'm reading a book written in 79 by William Schokraus called Sideshow, about the invasion of Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely fascinating, because it's the exact same terminology with the insurgents, and we had to bomb Cambodia to save American lives in Vietnam.
Right. Yeah, and look what it led to. It led to an absolute disaster in Cambodia. And you got cons who say, oh, and that's because we pulled out of Vietnam. Well, actually, it was Vietnam who stopped Pol Pot. It was Vietnam who invaded Cambodia and stopped the slaughter in Cambodia after we left. Good point. Tom, thank you very much. Yeah, it's like deja vu all over again. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Take a trip, take a break, take control, take advice from someone you know. Oh, come on over, come on in, pull up the seat and take a look.
So Tom should add squirrels to the alien surveillance list, writes George. He says, just a thought. He said, you never see any baby squirrels. You see lots of dead ones flattened out, but that's just to throw you off. But squirrels, they carry stuff in their paws or their mouth. It's a good size for a camera, isn't it? And they're all over the place, including the trees near your home and on the homes, and in some cases, in your attic. You also often see squirrels perched on their hind legs and just watching, peering at you through the window. They give out annoyed chittering noises of being disturbed in their duties. Maybe it's not just pigeons. Interesting, George. Let me contemplate that. Christy in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, thanks for calling, Christy. What's up?
I love the history lessons I get from you. And the thing about Posse Comitatus,
mm-hmm.
I thought about Kent State. And then recently I watched...
But that was a state militia. That was not a federal militia. That was the National Guard.
Okay. What about 1932, the Bonus March on Washington, when the World War One vets marched on Washington? And so Shantytown and Hoover called out the armed forces under MacArthur.
Right, MacArthur and Eisenhower rode in there and busted it up. The rationale for that was that was Washington, D.C. It's a federal city. It's under federal control. And you know, particularly at that time, Washington, D.C. has gained some autonomy since then. But as I recall, that was the rationale for why that was not a violation of Posse Comitatus, although there were people who were claiming at the time that it was. It certainly didn't do Herbert Hoover any help politically.
Okay, so Posse Comitatus is what?
Posse Comitatus says that the federal government may not use the military against civilians in the United States. And the District of Columbia was carved out as a separate area. It was, you know, originally the founders, they had this idea of there being a goddess for this country. You know, countries typically, like the Roman Republic and the Greek democracies, they had gods and goddesses who were protectors of the nations.
Right.
And so they created a goddess for this country. You'll see her statue on top of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., 19.5 feet tall. And they named her after Columbus, and her name was Columbia. And you see her in a lot of different poses. You see her as the war goddess, you know, holding arrows in her hand. You see her as the justice goddess, the Lady Liberty or Lady Justice holding the scales of justice in her hand. In fact, it's what John Ashcroft covered up her breasts in the Department of Justice building.
That's right.
You see her as the goddess of agriculture on the roof of the Capitol building in Vermont, you know, with wheat in her hand. I mean, she was all over the place. And most Americans don't realize that we have a goddess for our nation. And they created a district for her that was supposed to be so sacred and so separate from the normal rigmarole of daily life that good people could commit themselves to good governance in this district, separate from the concerns, the partisan and parochial concerns of individual states or other areas. And they created this district named after her, the District of Columbia, that where the people would be so kind of highfalutin, not like nose in the air, but so elevated, so separate from corruption, that they didn't even need to vote. They wouldn't be allowed to vote, so that therefore, you know, in federal elections and things, so that therefore they wouldn't have parochial self-interests. They'd be above that. That was the original idea. And that's why I remember one day when Louise and I lived in Vermont, walking out and picking up a newspaper, and the headline said, "Columbia dies over Texas." And I saw that headline and I thought, oh my God, this is right after Bush became president. And I thought, oh my God, he's done something. What did he take? You know, and it turned out it was the spaceship, that broke up over Texas. But it was such a weird kind of dissynchronous moment for me.
Okay.
But anyhow, that's the story of that. And I think that because the District of Columbia is such a uniquely separate thing that's why going after the Hoovervilles may not have been a violation of the Posse Comitatus Act, and it may even exempt D.C. I don't know. You know, it's been years since I've actually read the law, but that's I think what's going on. But Christy, good points, and thank you for raising them. I appreciate it. Julie in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. Hey, Julie, welcome to the program. Julie? No, Julie. Okay, let's go to Scott in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm the coordinator of MoveOn's Operation Democracy Council of Greater Pittsburgh, and everyone thought that Bush's veto would come on Monday.
You're talking about
program.
The veto of the S-chip?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I organized a rapid response veto rally for today, and obviously that's not going to happen. Somebody told me that if it's a veto-proof majority, and Bush lets it sit on his desk, it would automatically become law after a few days. And Bush might just do that to avoid the blame. Can you verify that?
My understanding, my recollection is that there was a veto-proof majority in the Senate, but not in the House. And I believe that there's this thing called, and maybe I'm, you know, if somebody correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think that the whole idea of a pocket veto is that if the president doesn't sign it, it doesn't become law. That may be something that I'm wrong about. I'm just going to have to look into that a little more, Scott. But, thanks for the heads up on that. We'll find out. Alan in Beverly Hills. Hey, Alan, got about a half a minute before we've got to wrap up this hour.
Okay. With the breakup of the Soviet Union, the breakup of Yugoslavia, wouldn't it be possible? Is it possible for California to secede from the Union and go its own way? So the boys.
It's pretty unlikely. Down in Texas and up in Vermont, because they were both independent republics before they joined the United States, you have people in both those states who assert that because they were republics, they have the right to do that. I'm not sure that California would follow that logic, and there's a lot of people who challenge that logic. And practically speaking, you know, it ain't going to happen. But it's an interesting one to ponder, Alan. It would make a great science fiction novel or an interesting scenario, make an interesting debate. How do we revive the American dream? What's going on with the economics of the world and of the country today. What direction are we going in? How do we bring back the American dream? What is the American dream for that matter? Coming up next.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Program on Air America Radio. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Okay, here's the details on pocket vetoes. Article 1 of the Constitution, which is about the House of about Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate, talking about how bills become law, Section 7. Says, if any bill shall not be returned by the president within 10 days, Sundays excepted, after it shall have been presented to him, the same shall be a law in like manner as if he has signed it, unless the Congress, by their adjournment, prevent its return, in which case it shall not be a law. You get it? There's two sides to this. If Congress is about to go into adjournment, if Congress adjourns within 10 days, and within that 10 days, they present legislation to the president, and he doesn't sign it, and Congress goes into adjournment, then that is called a pocket veto. It's no longer law. It doesn't become law. But on the other hand, if they give him a bill to sign, and he ignores it for 10 days, and they stay in session throughout those 10 days, then it does become a law. In 1929, the Supreme Court ruled on this in the pocket veto case, is what it's referred to. That, in fact, you know, that this is how it works, and this is the deal. So, anyhow, I just, and thanks to our many listeners and the folks in the chat room and whatnot for helping me track that down. Alan Greenspan, I want to get into in this hour what is the American dream and how do we bring it back? I find it very interesting that when surveys were done of school children back 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, and they were asked who were their heroes, who were their role models, typically their answers were political figures, historic typically, but political figures like George Washington, Ben Franklin, Abraham Lincoln. Nowadays, more often than not, it's rich people. I want to grow up to be like Bill Gates rather than I want to grow up to be like George Bush. Frankly, I can understand that. Nobody wants to grow up to be like George Bush. But the point is that we have had a fundamental recalibration in this country since the inauguration of Ronald Reagan in what it means to be an American and what the American dream is. Used to be, for 200 years in the United States, the American dream meant very often coming to a new land or, you know, being born here and having the opportunity to have to work hard and play fair by the rules and thus have the ability to own your own home, put your, you know, support a family, put your kids through school, not worry about going down in flames if somebody gets sick, not worry about going down in flames if you lose your job. The American dream is the dream of being part of a stable and secure middle class. And it's what we largely had in the United States for well over 50% of Americans, certainly not all Americans, but well over 50% of Americans, when over 30% of Americans, 35% was the peak in 1947 of unionization, over 35% of the American workforce was unionized. And for every union job, there's an equivalent job with the same pay and benefits and pension and everything out there in the private, in the non-union economy, because the union economy sets the floor for it. So you had 70% of the American workforce at that threshold in 1947. A time when corporations were paying about half the tax load in the United States, half the cost of the commons of the United States. Now they're paying about 7%. We had 70% of the American workforce able to be part of the middle class. Now only 7% of the private workforce of the United States is unionized. And this economic theory that Reagan called Reaganomics, that some people call trickle-down economics, that in Europe is referred to as neoliberalism, and it has nothing to do with liberalism, just like neoconservatism, as any conservative will tell you, is not the same as being conservative. The neocon, a true Barry Goldwater conservative, would never have invaded Iraq. The neoconservatives are aggressive. They're about change. They're about forcing change. The conservatives are about keeping things the way they are, resisting change. And this neoliberalism, this corporatism, you could call it a soft form of fascism that came into the United States with the Reagan administration, in large part as a consequence of the thinking of Milton Friedman at the Chicago School of Economics in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, and the writings of people like Tom Friedman with his Olive Tree and Lexus and The World is Flat, the celebration of great wealth, the denigration of working people, basically saying, hey, you're working in a textile mill in South Carolina and you want to make 15, 20 bucks an hour, and there's somebody in China who's willing to do that for $2 an hour? Tough luck, Charlie. The world is flat now. See, that kind of thinking. This is what is destroying the American dream. And so what has happened is that the American dream has become recalibrated. We don't talk, oddly enough, in America, we rarely talk about the American dream in the context anymore of having a good, stable, middle-class job and being and doing that for the rest of your life and being able to retire with a pension and have your house paid off by the time you retire. All the things that actually happened to my father. My dad worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years. And when he retired, his home was paid off. His car was paid off. His kids had grown up. They'd gone through school. Their grandchildren were in school. He had a pension. My mom is still drawing part of it. I mean, my dad died a year ago. He had health insurance until the day he died. All because he worked in a union shop. That's all going away now. And so now increasingly the American dream has become, will I win the lottery? The conservatives give lip service to this, a variety of this, by saying, oh, well, you know, you could always start you could be the next Microsoft. You could start a company and become a billionaire. But the fact of the matter is, speaking as somebody who has started a number of companies and built them up and sold them off, in one case to our employees, in other cases to other people, I can tell you that the old entrepreneurial idea, the entrepreneurial idea that reigned in the United States, that ruled the United States from its founding up until the 1970s or 80s, which was, if you're going to build a business, whether it's the corner dry cleaner or it's a bookstore or it's a clothing store or what a manufacturing company, whatever it may be, if you're going to build a business, you're building it for yourself and future generations of your own family. That got set aside because as deregulation happened in the 1980s and Ronald Reagan and his buddies using this new bizarre economic theory that, as I said, the Europeans called neoliberalism, as this came along, they said, we're not going to protect local communities anymore. We're not going to protect medium and small sized businesses anymore. And so those of you old enough to remember the 1960s and 70s or 50s for that matter or before, and even the early 1980s, you could travel across America and every city was different. Every city was unique. There were family-owned businesses that had been in the same family for 5 and 10 generations in every town across America. And they had unique names. The hotels looked different. The restaurants looked different. Everything was. Today, you could drop out of an airplane at 50,000 feet and, depending on the wind, land in one of probably 20 different states and have absolutely no idea where you are as you look around, because it looks just like every place else, because it's all owned by PepsiCo. It's all owned by a small handful of corporations. Well, one of the things that Greenspan and Bush did as these trade policies and so-called, you know, free trade, as this stuff started ripping apart the fabric of America, because we were no longer manufacturing things in the United States, so we were no longer generating wealth at the level of manufacturing. And even our service economy was being torn apart as you know, big companies like Microsoft were importing engineers from overseas, and hospitals are importing nurses now from the Philippines and things like that, you know, the H-1B visas and whatnot. Because we weren't producing wealth in the United States anymore, they said, okay, we're going to do two things. One, we're going to sell off this country. We're going to sell off America. And they're doing it aggressively. And two, we're going to encourage people to borrow until they're in hock up to their eyeballs in order to keep the economy going. Now, there's an end point to that. And the front page of today's Financial Times, European banks reveal their credit crisis damage. There's a broad consensus that we are not probably at that end point yet. We haven't seen the worst of this. And where are we going to go with this? And what do we do? How do we take it to the next step? How do we bring back the American dream to America?
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
The Germans are really getting around. I'll tell you, Angela Merkel is starting to roll back some of the, I'm going to call it conservative, rather than use the word that the Europeans would use, which is neoliberal, some of the conservative policies of her predecessor, Mr. Schroeder. What he did is he said, you know, unemployment benefits encourage people to be unemployed. So we're going to cut them back. And she's saying, no, nobody wants to be living on the edge like this. Maybe there's a couple of people, but, you know, it's a small percentage. You don't base an entire economy and an entire country on a few abusers, people who abuse the system, instead, particularly a large system that's there for everybody. The bottom line is that you have an unemployment system that is designed to help people if they're confronted with disaster. So Bertrand Benoit today in Berlin, writing in the Financial Times of London, Germany eyes higher jobless benefits and policy shift. And it's about how Angela Merkel is changing things, is core structural stuff. She's undoing what was referred to as the Hartz IV labor market reforms that basically capped out on unemployment benefits. And the article notes, the news sparked concern among economists. The German expert at Morgan Stanley said, there is a leftward shift in policies that reflects public opinion. It is legitimate in a democracy, but it is something one ought to be concerned about from an economic point of view. You know, Alan Greenspan couldn't have said it better. What she's planning on doing is extending the time that you can get unemployment benefits from 12 months currently up to 24 months to 2 years. For people over 50, and to 18 months if you're over 45, because these are the people who, when they get thrown out of work, have the hardest time finding a job. During that time, the unemployed person gets 67% of their last salary, two-thirds of their last salary. And when it runs out, they can get a flat rate benefit of $500 a month, 350 euros. Three-quarters of the German public, by the way, favors this. So here's an example of a woman who was elected actually on a relatively conservative platform who is taking Germany in a liberal direction because she gets it that in Germany, like in America, we don't elect leaders, we elect representatives. So what are we going to do here in America? Andy Tobias, the economic columnist, he has this column called Tough Years Ahead. And he notes, he says, here's how a friend of mine with a big heart puts it. And now he's quoting a letter from a friend of his. We just opened a plant in an industrial park financed a couple hours drive from Shanghai. Just your average 100 square mile business park. The all-in cost, that would be including benefits and everything. The all-in cost for a skilled worker is $1.20 an hour. The park has two golf courses, a hospital, schools, two lakes, housing, all modern, all brand spanking new. Good, clean working conditions. If you don't move your production here, your competition does, and you go bankrupt, putting all your other employees out of work. Any suggestions? Tobias suggests that we should lean on our foreign competitors to have the same environmental costs U.S. company. No, it's really simple. Let's go back to the trade system that we had in the United States from 1787 up until the 1980s, or the 1990s, arguably, when it finally fell apart when Clinton passed NAFTA and GATT and WTO. That protects our American jobs with tariffs. It's very simple. I mean, yes, we still have tariffs. Right now, if the Chinese want to sell a car in the United States, they have to pay about a 2% import tariff. But the Chinese are protecting their market. If General Motors wants to sell a car into China, they have to pay a 20% import tariff. So what's the result of that? If General Motors wants to sell cars in China, they build the factory in China. And by the way, it's cheaper to make them there anyway. See, it used to be that that was either illegal or impossible because of tax laws. Not illegal, but it would have been too expensive to do. And so companies stayed here, and they felt a commitment to the United States. But no more. No more. Ain't happening. A new Pew Research poll. This is incredible, 1988. Right, the last year of the Reagan administration. When Reaganism was just beginning to grab hold of America, they asked average Americans, do you feel like, you know, if we're a society of haves and have-nots, do you feel like you're in the have part or the have-not part? And 71% of Americans said that they were part of the haves. In 2001, 53% said that they were part of the haves. This summer, 2006, 2007, only 45% of Americans say they're part of the haves, as opposed to the have-nots. Harold Meyerson, writing about this, he says, these are epical shifts of epical significance. He says the big story here isn't Republican denial. It's the shattering of Americans' sense of a common identity in a time when the economy no longer promotes the general welfare. The world the New Deal built has been destroyed, and we are, as we were before the New Deal, two nations. Haves and have-nots, and the have-nots are growing faster than the haves. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This Saturday I'll be in Washington, D.C. at the Green Festival, speaking on the main stage at 6 o'clock on Saturday at the Washington, D.C. Convention Center, the District of the Goddess Columbia. And in the other Washington, on October 26th in Seattle, I will be signing books, my new book, Cracking the Code, which will be coming out in the next few weeks. In fact, we actually got an advance copy day before yesterday. I'll be at the Elliott Bay Bookstore on October 26th and on October 27th at Sonoma University, receiving the Project Censored Award. So that's what's going on this month. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. I just want to share very, very quickly three quick stories. Just basically the headlines and the take on these. The Financial Times today. Chinese stake at heart of 3Com takeover fears. 3Com is a super high-tech company here in the United States. Back in 83, I spent the day with Bob Metcalf, who was the founder of 3Com, did a profile of him. I wrote an article about him that was the cover story for a computer magazine that I was a contributing editor back at the time. And it looks like a Chinese company, which is an agency of the Chinese military, is buying a chunk of 3Com. And that's got some folks worried. But, hey, we got to sell off our country. I mean, we've got to sell off our companies because we've got all these debts. We've got this trade debt and we got this budget deficit. Here's another one. This is from the Wall Street Journal today. Anita Raghavan writing about how if you are wealthy enough to qualify to put money into a hedge fund, most hedge funds will not take money from you unless your net worth is at least $5 million and you have at least $1 million liquid that you can afford to lose. Then you can invest in a hedge fund. Turns out the hedge funds have been using this little slick little trick where they move their funds in some strange way to using derivatives, to quote the Wall Street Journal, offshore so that the income is not taxable. In fact, this is the headline. Hedge funds could lose offshore shelter. And then Anita notes, the U.S. Treasury loses more than $1 billion in potential tax revenue each year through this practice. They pitch their hedge fund clients ways to make dividend payouts on U.S. stocks even fatter by avoiding taxes on them. And these are U.S. stocks. And here's the third. Dollar lifts exporters, blunting housing bust. In other words, the fact that our dollar is collapsing is making it cheaper for our stuff to be sold overseas, which helps companies that want to sell things overseas, which is a good thing for the U.S. economy. But it's the wrong way to do it. It's essentially saying, oh, we're going to become Mexico. We're going to become poorer. We're going to pay less to our workers, but we'll be able to export more because China's getting wealthier. And the Europeans are getting a lot wealthier. It's amazing. 1-866-303-2270. Dave in L.A. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to commend you. You are so right on about some of this economic talk, and I'm glad you're delving into it more and more. But the your aspect of the lotto for retirement, you know, this is why we're seeing a lot of these bubbles happen, is that people realize they don't have a pension and they need to do something. So they jump into stocks in the 2000. They jump into housing this last go round and try to make that big buck. And this short quarter-to-quarter mentality that we have with the corporations is also a problem.
But yeah, there's all these get-rich-quick seminars out there and stuff. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and we'll see more of them as this becomes – you're seeing more and more commercials on TV for retirement to target the baby boomers.
But and the other thing you're going to see is more and more of multi-level marketing. Turn your friends into customers. You, too, can become a salesperson.
Pyramid schemes are just around the corner. I can see it now. But on this economic theories – I've been delving into this largely because of you. I've been reading up on Keynesian economics and Hayek, and I urge everybody to take a look at supply-side economics and demand-side economics on Wikipedia. It's a great place to go. And one of the more interesting things I found about demand or supply-side economics, you know, they tell us it's all about, you know, giving the wealthy more money so it'll trickle down. If you read into it, it's hilarious. It's not even that. What they're saying in the basic theory is that supply creates its own demand, meaning production creates its own demand.
Right. If you put more stuff out there, people will buy it.
That's right. You know, I guess, I don't know, keep it up with the Joneses or whatever urges, but they have to have money to buy it. Personally, I think neither one of these theories are correct in themselves. I think like all things in life, it's a pendulum. It should, you know, they push it to one side or the other. Where it really needs to belong is in the middle, somewhere in
between. Well, that's what John Maynard Keynes was doing, was he was, you know, we have to have demand. You have to have demand. And so in order to create demand, if the government has to be the employer of last resort, so be it. But that demand then will stimulate an increase in supply. You also want to do everything you can to make sure that supply is held domestically, so that the demand is met by domestic companies rather than overseas companies, so you protect your markets, you know, with things like tariffs and domestic content laws and things. And,
absolutely.
And you know, It's one whole package, and it worked brilliantly. The United States became the most powerful nation in the world. It became the largest industrial democracy that the world had ever seen. We were, the day that Ronald Reagan took office in the United States, 25% of our workforce was unionized. The middle class was absolutely at its peak, and we were the largest creditor in the world. More nations and more companies external to the United States owed us money than any other nation in the world. Today, we are now, we were the world's largest importer of raw materials and exporter of finished goods. We brought in iron ore to the United States, and we shipped out automobiles and television sets. We have now completely reversed that. We are now the world's largest debtor. We are more in debt than any other country in the world. We're the largest debtor in the world. We used to be the largest creditor. And we are now the world's largest importer of finished goods and the world's largest exporter of raw materials. We are strip mining America. We're exporting iron ore. We're exporting lumber. We're even exporting waste. We're sending trash to China to be recycled. We're exporting our raw materials so that other countries, which still have manufacturing capability, can turn it into finished goods, which we then buy back from them. It's nuts. And
it's the difference between a sustainable economy and this craziness. If you don't have the cash going back in to create the demand, you know, supply, then you have to go into debt. And that's
absolutely. And that's what Greenspan figured out about 10 years ago was this thing ain't working. This dog don't hunt. But they're not going to let go of their ideology, their supply side ideology, their Friedmanism. And so, the only way that he could keep the economy going was to turn on the credit spigot, to make money really, really cheap so that he could stimulate demand by getting people to go into debt to buy things and thus setting up
debt.
Yeah, exactly. And thus. That's right. And thus setting up a potential disaster for the United States. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Very, very well said. Dagmar in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Dagmar, what's up?
Hi. I just had a couple of thoughts I wanted to bounce off. I used to think it was Reagan and stuff, but it seems like there was something fundamental occurred in the economy. I just use one example. In 1974, one could go out fairly quickly and easily, and when the minimum wage was $2.05, and get like a $7 an hour job at the now infamous post office, and say by 1988, it would change to the point where, I don't want to personalize it too much, but I waited four years, and I agree that in 1974 it was inefficient. One guy came in maybe twice a week, reeking of liquor, and they couldn't fire him. But it seems like it went from the deep freeze into the fire, where they said, well, now one person could do 10 times as much. So it was like a massive speed up.
If I may interrupt you, Dagmar, and feel free to challenge me on this, but I don't believe that it's so much that the post office changed. I think that the reason why it was easy to get a good paying job with a pension and benefits at the post office in the 70s and it became more difficult in the 80s was because in the 70s, the post office was competing with a lot of other employers out there, like the tool and die shop that my dad worked at and one of my brothers worked at. The post office was competing with all these other manufacturing jobs out there in the United States that also paid well and had good benefits. And as free trade policies, in quotes, and these insane economic policies began to propagate across our economy throughout the late 70s and early 80s, and Margaret Thatcher started in England in 79 and Reagan in 81 here in the United States, a lot of those jobs that the post office used to be competing against went away. And so as a result, the only jobs left with good pensions, good benefits, and decent pay were those in the government sector because those couldn't be outsourced. And so it became harder and harder, and that's why it's so much harder now to get a good job at the post office.
Yeah, you mentioned Thatcher. I heard once, I never heard the figures for Reagan, but they said under Thatcher that 60% did better and 40% did worse. 40% sounded like a really high number to me, especially if you consider they probably weren't doing the best to begin with. But the point I was going to say was that I used to think it was just government and the theory that government work parasitizes wealth and other people's tax money as opposed to commerce, which creates wealth. But I've been hearing more and more stories that say that the same type of speed up and high, I'll just call it harder work and higher pressure and is in the private sector as well. And I just thought maybe if that was a more fundamental change that even went deeper than Reaganomics,
it's
productivity and some kind of globalization and competition.
Yeah. It's a piece of it, Dagmore, and you have your finger on it, but it even goes a step beyond that, and that is that the government is not a parasite in as much as it's taking tax dollars out of the so-called productive economy, because what the government does is it provides the infrastructure that allows there to be a productive economy. In fact, the vast majority of the wealth of a society is not the individual companies in that society that are, quote, producing wealth. It's the commons. It's all the stuff that is the government, that we the people own collectively, that facilitates that wealth.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Check just ain't stretching like it mattered once before. Cause good jobs are all gone, left you in some big box store. Between food and rent and medicine, seems the suit's frayed a little bit more. When the boss cuts that last corner, they all count on those doors. When the truckers hauling sweatshop stuff won't stop there anymore. When the folks won't cross your pickets cause their boat's the same as yours. That is one big union.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman Radio Program. Victoria Jones on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
I noticed that John Corzine is suing George Bush. This is novel. The state of New Jersey suing the Bush administration over the S-CHIP program.
Yes, indeed they are. I don't think they're going to get very far on this, but, I mean, good luck to them, quite frankly. A number of states are not happy with the president over the S-CHIP program, but Corzine is the first to do it. And he should, you know, basically hang on to his seat and wear a seatbelt while he's doing it.
Yeah, indeed, indeed.
I think he's in for a bumpy ride.
I think so, but at the same time, I mean, the basis of what he's saying is that there is a process for making rules that involves a collaboration between the states and the executive branch. The executive branch being charged with carrying out the laws made by the legislative branch at the federal level, and that process is something that they had been working on. He says the same administration previously signed off on our decision to cover the 10,000 kids that they're now seeking to kick out of S-CHIP, and the lawsuit we filed today demonstrates we simply will not let that happen. And he says that basically what happened was instead of this collaborative rulemaking process, that George Bush simply changed the rules of the game by writing a letter and sent it to him and said, here you go, new rules, 10,000 kids, out. And he says, wait a minute, what happened? We're supposed to talk this stuff over. What about democracy?
I think if the Bush administration, my defense would be, look, I've been doing this for 6.5 years now. Why would you be surprised? I never consult about anything. You've got no defense in terms of my not consulting you. You should have known that going in.
Yeah, all the more the tragedy. And hopefully this will be for the citizens of New Jersey and, you know, anybody else in the United States who happens to notice, but it's a big story in New Jersey and any other states that may join Corzine in suing Bush on this. This will be a wake-up call to them about how toxic this administration really is when it comes to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in these United States.
I think other states will join New Jersey, actually.
Yeah, yeah. I would be surprised if they didn't. I think there's 10 or 12 states, as I recall, that have modified their programs, you know, to allow up to 250% of the level of poverty, and the Bush administration has gone in and said, oh, no, you don't, and it's going to be an interesting one to watch. That and our, you know, everybody, well, not everybody, but many people were expecting Bush to veto S-CHIP by now. What's going on with that?
They're expecting him to what? I didn't quite hear you.
To veto S-CHIP. There was we had a caller who said he was trying to organize protests in advance of that. But was the increase in the S-CHIP program that just passed through the House and Senate, has that gone to conference?
Yeah, that was in the Defense Authorization Bill.
Yeah, it was attached to the defense, and he's talking about vetoing it as a consequence of that. Has that bill gone through conference and been delivered to the president?
I don't believe it's been delivered to the president yet, so he wouldn't be ready to veto it. I think he will veto it quite publicly, by the way. When Dana Perino was asked about that, I was there, and she'll sort of say, oh no, it'll be a private thing. She didn't say that at all. She kind of indicated that it would be a public spectacle.
Yeah. He's really playing to an increasingly small base of millionaires and billionaires in the United States. The 350,000 people in this country, roughly, who are in the top 0.001% of income. It's becoming so obvious. So, you know, his old joke, when he spoke at a $2,000 plate fundraiser, you know, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base. It's becoming so obvious that that's really the only group that he has any interest in catering to.
Which must be very frustrating to rank-and-file Republicans who realize that they've got an election coming up in 2008, which they have to win, and they're not doing well in the polls. In this new Washington Post ABC poll, Congress is doing extremely badly, worse than the president. Republicans in Congress are doing even worse than Democrats in Congress.
Yeah, and people's frustration with Congress is that they haven't ended this war or this occupation of Iraq. I mean, it seems like such an obvious thing, and yet you still have Democrats who are saying, well, we'll just wait another few months. It's like they're doing it in Freedmen units now, you know, another 6 months. Anyhow, what's going on in Washington, D.C. beyond these things?
Well, there is actually a lot of reaction to this poll. A lot of people are talking about this poll because there really is a sense that, oh, my God, is it as bad as this? And the answer being, yes, it is. And then they're looking at Senator Lindsey Graham, who has turned around and said, well, we're going to give the Iraqis 90 days. And if they're not able to sort themselves out in 90 days, well, they're not going to sort themselves out at all, and we have to start looking at withdrawal. And people are turning around and being a bit surprised at that. Other than that, people are also very interested in the story that All Things Considered is putting out about Giuliani and how the conservatives are now seriously considering a third-party nominee because they are just thinking that they will not vote for him because of his pro-abortion stance.
Yeah, Tony Perkins leading that charge, not the guy who was the slasher in Psycho, I guess. His name was Tony Perkins, wasn't it?
Anthony Perkins, that's right, yes.
Yeah. But the other Tony Perkins. He was on Hardball last night. He was being interviewed by Chris Matthews, and he said, no, we're not talking about a third-party candidate. I think they don't want to split the Republican Party, but they are trying to figure out who they're going to support. It's going to be.
They don't know. They don't have a clue. There's nobody they like.
Well, I think that they've lost so much power, it's just starting to dawn on them. Victoria, great talking with you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, Sam Kasman. He's all concerned about light bulbs. Oh, my God, the government wants to regulate your light bulbs. I'll be calming him down. Plus, the best of the rest of news and your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. And never forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. It depends on you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.